You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Wednesday, November 13, 2013. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, Isaac William Martin on rich people's movements. Also on the program today, Rand Paul desperately seeking a way to get out of his plagiarism conundrum, complains that the government is outlawing donuts. Yes. 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 Also, the case that may really cripple unions' ability to organize heard at the Supreme Court yesterday. A big leak coming from WikiLeaks. The entire chapter on so-called intellectual property that is being negotiated in secret amongst the 11 nations seeking to sign on to the Trans-Pacific Partnership. It's leaked online. It's as bad as we had been talking about. Fortunately, there is great opposition in the House to fast-track authority for the president to negotiate this deal and pass it basically in secret. All that and more on today's program. Janet Yellen hearings commencing on the in the Senate, if not already, then momentarily, on her confirmation hearings to be the new chair of the Federal Reserve. We've got all that and more for you today. Before we get to Isaac William Martin.
Podcast awards.
Oh, yes. Podcast awards, folks. You now have two more days, including today. No, I should say maybe three more days. I think until 12 p.m. Friday. Or I should say 12 a.m. Friday. East Coast time, I believe. Podcastawards.com. Head over there right now. Vote for the Majority Report for Best News and Politics Podcast and People's Choice Politics.
You have until 9 p.m. Eastern Time on November 15th.
Okay, so that's Friday, 9 p.m. Eastern Time. You can vote today, tomorrow, and then Friday. You have a chance to vote three more times. And we need those votes. We need hundreds, if not thousands, of you. And it should be easy to get thousands of you to do it. I'm not talking tens of thousands. I'm saying a couple of thousand would be a fraction of how many of you listen to the free show. And if you just went over there and voted two times, three times over the next 3 days, all you got to do is vote for those, for us, for those two things, put your email address in, then go verify your email address, and bingo, bango, we will be a three-time winner of the podcast awards. Bingo bango. I'm talking like a man. Like I was
bingo bango, we win, eh?
There you go.
But seriously, and like 40 seconds max to vote.
No, that's even
I don't know. I
think in like 10 seconds. No, it's quick to vote.
Quick to vote. And then you just got to open up your email and then just verify it.
But that whole verification thing, just so it's very like you click a link.
Yes, it's
very,
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 very
easy,
quick,
folks.
All right. So let's talk about this. Now, folks, I know in the past I've probably said we're not going to talk about Sarah Palin anymore, but there's some moments that are just too fun to let slip through the cracks, as it were. This is good for even for Sarah Palin. She is being interviewed by Jake Tapper. She has a new book out. As you know, there is a war on Christmas that happens every year as secularists and Jews and Muslims and fallen Christians and Hindus and Sikhs, I guess, and Buddhists, and we all get together to plot the war on Christmas, and thank God there are people like Sarah Palin out there fighting the good fight, selling her books. Well, here she is being interviewed by Jake Tapper on her experience running for the president as a woman and on other experiences that others may experience running for president. I don't know. I get stupid when I talk about it.
So I know you wouldn't vote for Hillary Clinton if she ran for president, but I remember in 08, after you got the nod, you talked about the unfair media treatment that Hillary Clinton got when she was running for president.
Yes.
And you probably feel like you got some of that unfair media treatment as well. Sexism. What, if there's any woman out there thinking of running for president, what can she expect?
She could expect that sexism, but you overcome it. You know, you ignore it. You do thicken your skin and you march forth with your message, your priorities, your agenda that you believe is right for America. Yeah, Hillary Clinton was mistreated when it came to appearances, when it came to wardrobe, you know, petty, superficial things that the men don't ever seem to hear much about, but a woman candidate will.
Governor Christie hears about his appearance.
That's because it's been extreme, okay? So it's hard to, it's hard for some people not to comment on it.
Yeah, Jake. it's impossible not to comment on it. I feel her pain. I really do. It's extreme. There you go, Sarah Palin. She's really on a tour. Just handed it to Christie. I'm surprised she just stopped there. Well, you know, Jake, when Governor Christie sits around the state house, he sits around the state house. He's just got to go. He's just got to overcome. He's just got to go fourth and fifth and sixth and seventh, if you know what I mean. Jake, I couldn't help it.
It's just so extreme.
It's so extreme. Oh, God bless her. God bless her. Bless her heart.
I'm talking about being a woman, not a blimp, Jake.
Yeah, come on, Jake. Come on, Jake. I could see it if a woman was super ugly, if it was extreme. Unbelievable. Really?
Hillary's not exactly a looker, but it's not extreme.
No.
No.
All right, folks. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Isaac William Martin. This is an interview I did with him towards the end of last week. And we'll take a break, and we'll be right back with that. We are back on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program Isaac Williams Martin. He is the author of Rich People's Movements, the grassroots campaign to untax the 1%. And, of course, he is a professor in the Department of Sociology and Urban Studies at the University of California, San Diego. Welcome to the program, Professor.
Thank you so much for having me.
So this is an incredibly timely book in many respects, because we are hearing of a split between the establishment Republican Party and the Tea Party part of the Republican Party, for lack of a better characterization. And in many respects, my sense is this is about tactics and maybe basically two different sort of operations. But the agenda is one that seems to be shared. They have a shared agenda, and you talk about these grassroots movements to essentially untax very wealthy people. Let's talk a little bit about the history. This is not a new phenomenon.
No, indeed. It goes back to the beginnings of the income tax. The federal income tax was enacted in 1913 after the 16th Amendment to the Constitution made it possible. And then it rapidly, in the First World War, grew into an important source of revenue for the federal government. And immediately after the war, some very rich people started mobilizing to repeal the income tax or to cap the top rate of income tax or otherwise to protect rich people against taxation.
Now, what should we glean from the fact that it took rich people that long? I mean, it's not that long, but I mean, why was there not sort of, why did the movement take that long to sort of emerge? Because this is sort of indicative of a dynamic that you talk about, the emergence of these movements through the years.
Yeah, well, at first the very beginning of the income tax, that was a very hard-fought campaign. Progressives, the labor movement, the radical farmers movement, several women's organizations campaigned very hard to persuade people to make that law. And so it was a very hard-fought campaign, and the forces of the rich lost. But the income tax at first was really only a symbolic measure. It targeted only a few of the very richest people, and nobody thought it was going to grow into the major source of revenue that it is today. So it was only after the income tax started to grow, and grow rapidly in the First World War, that rich people started to realize that they couldn't take its repeal for granted and that they were going to have to campaign against it.
To what extent did Prohibition have to do with this? Because my understanding is that the Anti-Saloon League also joined forces in promoting the income tax, because prior to that time, the federal government got most of its money from basically taxing booze, and they wanted to sort of decouple that revenue source.
You know, this is a fascinating history. Yes, there were a lot of temperance and prohibition activists who were active in the campaign for the income tax for precisely that reason. They wanted to get the federal government off its dependence on revenues from alcohol taxes. But they were only one part of a big and diverse movement. The labor movement was really active in pushing for it, and especially, I think, mobilized farmers were really key, because farmers were paying property taxes. And they saw lots of wealthy people in cities whose property was going untaxed, because their property didn't take the form of land. It took the form of, you know, stock certificate. So the income tax was really, there were a lot of different forces pushing for the income tax.
Okay, so the income tax, rich people essentially get the idea that they are now on the hook following the war, and the sense that they get that the federal government is starting to see that this is a significant revenue source. And I would imagine that Prohibition coming in there sort of like sealed that deal too, that they what happens at that point? I mean, this is when J.A. Arnold really gets involved in the sort of, I guess, the story.
Yeah, so there were a lot of very rich people who were very suddenly very scared of the income tax, realized that it was expanding, and feared that it might lead to the confiscation of all their property. And at that point, this character named, you mentioned him, J.E. Arnold, James Asbury Arnold, who really is a fascinating guy, grew up in populist country, just a few miles away from William Jennings Bryan, lived his whole life around radical farmers and their protest, movements, and watched them very closely and took what he learned and went to work on behalf of cutting taxes for rich people. And so what Arnold did was he traveled around the South and the Midwest like any populist organizer on the lecture circuit, organizing local clubs, but instead of organizing local clubs of the Farmers Alliance, he was organizing what he called the Bankers Leagues, who took as their mission calling for a limitation on the top tax rate, and calling to limit the taxes of very rich people. And they petitioned Congress over a period of years to amend the Constitution to cap the top tax rate.
And I mean, what was J.A. Arnold's stake in this? I mean, in other words, was he a one percenter, or was he, I mean, did he have a political idea?
Absolutely not. He was not an especially rich guy. He was hustling really hard for money the whole time, like anyone who's sort of been around politics and community organizing knows a lot of the professionals in that world have to work really hard to get contributions, and that was sort of Arnold's story. He seems to have been a true believer who really felt like the income tax was the beginning of the end, and he even wrote a book in 1938 to make the argument that the income tax was really like the fall from grace and the end of the Garden of Eden, and that everything was going downhill since the 16th Amendment.
Was there a significant agitation at that time or sense that, I mean, it has reemerged, I don't know if it's, something that happens every 100 years or, as a construct of the Tea Party, but, particularly in the libertarian movement, I've had extended conversations, particularly with like Ron Paul fans saying the income tax is unconstitutional. Was that an argument that was contemporaneous for a guy like Arnold?
Yeah, no, I've heard a lot of that too, and that's a more recent argument. So they believed it was constitutional because they had lived through the process that amended the Constitution to make it possible, and they just wanted to change the Constitution. So they began campaigning for another constitutional amendment to repeal the 16th Amendment. And many of the rich people who got involved were rich people who actually had previously been involved in the campaign to repeal prohibition. I'm talking now about the late 1930s, and some of these rich folks sort of fought to repeal prohibition because they wanted to bring back the alcohol excise tax so that their income taxes could go down. Well, their income taxes didn't go down, so they decided their next move was to repeal the income tax amendment, and they started bankrolling J.A. Arnold's operation to really build up the grassroots pressure to make that happen.
And I mean, I don't want to get caught on this tangent, but I am so fascinated by that notion that the arguments at the time were repeal it, as opposed to, like, I mean, I've had so many conversations with people who tell me that, I don't know, it was the state of Kansas didn't really have quorum, and they sent their votes to Washington saying, I mean, what, from a, and I don't want to get too off on a tangent here, but from a sociological, I mean, you're looking at this as a sociologist. I mean, what can we glean from the fact that there's this new sort of body of reasoning behind the income tax as being not just wrong from a policy statement, but fundamentally, because when you said that Arnold talked about this as being sort of the original sin, the people I talk to today about this think that not only was it the original sin, it was the original fraud.
Yeah, well, this idea of the income tax as original sin has been running through these movements for all of the last 100 years. There was a famous book written in the 1950s called "The Income Tax: Root of All Evil," by a guy named Frank Chodorov, who was a really influential player in on the right in the 1950s. And so this thread of argument sort of runs through the whole movement. But it really is a later 20th century invention, this idea that the income tax was never somehow never legitimately ratified in the first place. And folks will, you know, point to things like missing commas in you know, state resolutions that ratified the 16th Amendment or what have you, and try to concoct these arguments that they really have no legal footing. But I actually see that as a really common kind of thing that people do when they fear their government and think their government is illegitimate. They'll reach back to an imagined, original, better, truer government. And so here are folks who are sort of saying, you know, no, there's a true constitution, you know, that's different from the constitution we actually have. In my true constitution, they say, there is no 16th Amendment. And it's this idea that somehow original authority that they just know exists is somehow pure of the thing that they think is evil.
This is like the Constitution in Exile movement, right?
Sorry?
Is this known as the Constitution in Exile movement?
I've not heard it under that name, but it's got a lot of it's an argument that crops up in a lot of different movements. It's got a lot of adherence. It's had a lot of adherence in the militia movement for the last 20 years.
All right. Well, let's go back to so J. A. Arnold, and he. Are there policy results from what J. A. Arnold did with his tax clubs, and just how many, you know? Well, tell me what the political and policy results were of J. A. Arnold's sort of roadshow.
Yeah. So the I'll start with the policy results, and this is one where I think there's a really important lesson for today. So Arnold's tax clubs were lobbying the federal government for really steep tax cuts on rich people. And they were also trying to abolish the estate tax. Well, they didn't get everything they wanted. Nevertheless, they did get Congress to pass some really steep income tax cuts and estate tax cuts. And especially the income tax cuts in 1926, it was the biggest cut in the top income tax rate in American history. Now, it didn't go as deep as the activists at the grassroots wanted, and they were still dissatisfied. But it wouldn't have happened without the pressure that they were putting on Congress.
Mm.
I think that tells us a lot about the split that you were talking about at the beginning of our interview between the sort of grassroots Tea Party type activists and the more establishment Republicans. The split that we hear about. There are differences in policy. But it's differences where the grassroots are pushing for something just a little more extreme than the establishment wants. And the establishment is usually happy to have them out there pushing. Because when you have the grassroots out there pushing for something very extreme, you can position yourself as the moderate. And you can say, oh, you know, gosh, we can't repeal the income tax. That would be crazy. So let's just cut the top rate, and maybe that'll cool down those hotheads over there.
And a lot of political scientists talk about this as being the Overton window, the sort of the margins which define where the center ends up being, and what is the sort of the centrist, policy position on anything is between these margins.
I think that's a good way to think about it. If you can, the game here being, you know, if they can move the right margin further to the right, then the middle of that window also moves further to the right. You can also think about it as a game of good cop, bad cop,
right,
where the grassroots are playing the bad cop, and then the establishment, the more establishment conservatives get to come in and say, hey, you know, we're not crazy like them. We just want to, you know, cut taxes on rich people by this much.
And so let's, I mean, getting back to J. A. Arnold's time, and sort of almost, I also want to talk about sort of the definition of grassroots, but what was the implication? We see what the policy implication was of J. A. Arnold at that time in terms of the tax cuts. What did he capture? I mean, was there a popular movement really that existed? And how do we define, like, what is grassroots? It sounds like J. A. Arnold was grassroots to me. I'm a little more skeptical as to what that word means in this day and age.
Yeah, it's a good question, right? It was originally a word that, of course, was invented by the farmers' movement, and you can hear the agrarian roots of that word. It's people who, you know, farmed for a living, talking about the land when they said they were the grassroots. I guess when I talk about it in this context, what's most distinctive about these movements, these rich people's movements, is that the people involved with them are campaigning on behalf of the rich, but they're not always rich people themselves. And they're using tactics that we associate with popular movements. So demonstrations, rallies, marches, petitions, sometimes civil disobedience, all of these are sort of outsider tactics that you don't think of as the usual repertoire of rich people who have a lot of ways to reduce their taxes that are much easier. You know, it's very, very easy for a rich person to buy themselves a congressperson and get a tax break written into the code instead of going out and demonstrating. So the tactics are tactics we associate with the grassroots. Now, as to who the people were, in the beginning of Arnold's day, his tax clubs were actually small-town bankers throughout the South and the Midwest who were not themselves in the top tax brackets, but thought that it would help them attract investors if they stood up for tax cuts on the very rich. But later waves of the movement attracted different groups of people, many of them sort of middle to upper income people in different industries, often self-employed, but some of them salaried managers from all over the country. And so they're grassroots in the sense that they were not themselves the really big business owners, and in the sense that they were not themselves part of the Washington lobbying establishment. But certainly there was very little working class support for most of these groups.
I mean, it's fascinating, too, because, I mean, I think the difference, or you tell me, I mean, what there seems to be the fundamental difference in our era over the past, you know, and I would say this era of the Tea Party movement is really a phenomenon. You know, it was appropriated, I think, by the sort of more mainstream Republicans from Ron Paul's movement, which identified as the Tea Party movement, but that there's just a tremendous amount of money providing an infrastructure for this energy that, you tell me, did it exist at that time?
No, it did not. I agree with you that this is something basically new since the 1980s. The J.A. Arnold in the 1920s, he did get donations from some of the richest capitalists in the United States. He went to Andrew Mellon, who was at that time not only one of the richest people in the country, but was also Secretary of the Treasury, and hit him up for a personal donation to these tax clubs. And Mellon didn't make a personal donation at that time, but he did connect Arnold with lots of other leaders of some of the biggest companies in the country. And Arnold came away from that meeting with $5,000. Which, you know, in 1924 is more than it is today, but it was not the kind of massive investment that we see the Koch brothers and other very rich people in the United States making in Tea Party mobilization. I think that the movement today is awash in money, and that really does change the game. They really do have more richer infrastructure than any of these movements ever had in the past.
And it's fascinating to me, too, because I think you describe as J.A. Arnold as sort of he became, you know, he was not wealthy, but he became a professional agitator on behalf of the rich. And it seems to me that dynamic, there are literally thousands upon thousands of J.A. Arnolds in this instance who are making money off of this agitation, regardless of where it goes, because of all this money that's flooded into the system.
I think it's now become a career path. I think that Arnold was a creative entrepreneur who sort of invented this thing. But I think now, yeah, it's a whole world. It's becoming a profession. So I think that tells us that this kind of mobilization is going to be sticking around for a very long time in American politics.
Yeah, it's fascinating in that regard. And I want to jump to Andrew Mellon at that time, because I didn't know is that Andrew Mellon essentially came up with the Laffer curve. I mean, I don't think we called it the Laffer curve at that time, but he came up with that idea that the less you tax, the more revenue you get.
Yeah, Andrew Mellon actually wrote a Nation of People's Business where he tried to make that case to the voters in order to get them to support his proposal for tax cuts on the very rich.
It's fascinating. It's had some legs.
It's had some legs.
Next up is sort of historically a figure that stands out is Vivian Kellams. Tell us about Vivian Kellams, because she also speaks to the appropriation of tactics, and it seems to me on some level it's beyond tactics. It is placing the rich people's anti-tax movement in the context of a liberty movement, of an emancipation movement in some way.
Yeah, exactly. So Vivian Kellams was the daughter of a suffrage activist. She was a fascinating character. She ended up going into business making certain kinds of industrial equipment, and then made a lot of money during the Second World War, and decided she didn't want to pay income taxes anymore. She was also at the time an activist for the Equal Rights Amendment. She was an avowed feminist in the 1940s, at a time when that was obviously very, very hard to be, and stood up for the rights of women, but then took what she had learned in the women's movement and in the feminist movement and decided to use those styles of argument and those tactics on behalf of repealing the income tax. So she began to organize civil disobedience against the income tax, drawing on lessons she said she had learned from older suffrage activists who would get arrested in the struggle for the vote.
And this is taking place in the 40s and 50s, is that right?
In the 40s and 50s, we think of this as a very conservative time, of course, and you know, we remember the 1950s as a time when women really had many fewer options than today, and so to imagine I think she was a very courageous figure, Vivian Kellams, you know, standing up for the rights of women, but also then taking that set of tactics and standing up for the rights of the very rich. It's just a very surprising episode in our history.
How much did that carry through? I mean, you know, on this program we've talked a lot about the split that took place in the late 60s between the populist economic left and the social emancipation left. And I wonder, how much of what Vivian Kellams was doing at that point bled into the 60s. I mean, or am I just, did she just borrow the tactics and some of the rhetoric, or did it actually have some type of resonance in terms of the relationship between social emancipation cleaving itself from the sort of the what we would consider populist economics for the populace as opposed to the 1%?
Yeah, I absolutely think it was influential. She didn't just sort of, she wasn't just this wasn't just a one-off thing. She was very good at propagating these ideas and these styles of action. And so she's the one who really popularizes the term civil disobedience and teaches people on the right what civil disobedience is and that they can do civil disobedience against the income tax. And she's doing all of this, by the way, before the civil rights movement gets in full swing, before Brown v. Board of Education, before the Montgomery bus boycott, and so she's teaches people this set of tactics, teaches people this set of arguments that then do carry through other anti-income tax protest organizations. And it's very clear in the historical record. There's this moment in the 1950s when Kellams and a lot of the women who are her comrades in arms arrive at leadership positions in a bunch of these right-wing organizations, and the rhetoric shifts, the demands become more radical, and people become more willing to do kinds of unruly protests rather than the sort of polite lobbying behind the scenes that is more customary for wealthy people.
And then we see the next sort of great, or at least one of the next great sort of tax revolts comes in California, in the shape of property taxes. And this is one that the Proposition 13 resonates with me, because I was in Massachusetts going to high school when its cousin property, Proposition 3, I think it was, hit Massachusetts, and then all of a sudden my schools just got decimated. Just tell us about that.
Yeah, that would have been Proposition 2.5. Well, that was a very important moment in American history, when this was a moment when property taxes were increasing rapidly, and because property assessors were suddenly doing their job better than they ever had done, and were actually keeping track of property values, and so as people's homes became more valuable, suddenly they were being taxed on it. There were a lot of grassroots movements, both of the right and of the left, trying to protect homeowners from being displaced by their rising tax burdens. But it was the movements of the right that really seized the day and wrote into state constitutions in California, in Massachusetts, and a lot of other places, these limitations on the local property tax that capped the maximum rate of tax and capped how much it could increase. These have had really harmful effects on public schools and on other sort of funding for other local government functions. But they also had the effect of inspiring right-wing activists to try the same trick at the federal level. And so in the 1970s and 1980s, we see a lot of right-wing activists trying to write essentially a Proposition 13-style cap on taxes into the federal constitution.
Mm. All right, and so let's move up to the present day. One of the things you discuss in your book is that the we see these rich people movements arise when there is a new there's a perception of a new policy threat to the interests of the rich. And let's talk about what I mean from your perspective, and it's interesting to get from a sociological perspective. How did the Tea Party sort of congeal, and what was it in relation to? I mean, I can't help but think that part of it was just having a black president, frankly.
I do think part of it was just having a black president. And there's wonderful research on this by the political science Christopher Parker, who's done some survey research to show that perceptions of Obama among Tea Party supporters are just extreme on average. And it's quite interesting research. There were other things going on too. And of course, the critical one is the Affordable Care Act. If you'll recall, The first time we saw really massive grassroots Tea Party mobilization was right around the time of the passage of the act. It was the protesters were really concerned about the perceived threat posed by Obamacare, and some of that was about the imaginary death panels, and some of that was around the threat that people perceived associated with the small tax increases on wealthy people in the plan. So I do think the policy threat really played an important role in getting people mobilized. I'm sure your listeners remember the town hall meetings around the Affordable Care Act, when a lot of right wing people mobilized to go to those congressional town hall meetings, and that really was sort of an incubator for the grassroots side of the Tea Party.
I mean, it's fascinating to me that, I mean, you know, there seems to be sort of four different stories, conventional wisdom stories about what the Tea Party is in some respects. I mean, you know, we hear the Frank Santelli's rant on the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, and that this was about the bailouts, and it was about, you know, these people complaining about taxes when their taxes were literally at the lowest, no matter who it was that was complaining at that time, the lowest level they had been in 70 years. There was no one alive, practically, whose taxes had ever been at a different point. I mean, unless they were taxed when they were, like, I guess, 12 or something, or 15.
Which brings me to an important thing to understand about these movements is that it's not because they don't come about because taxes are actually too high. They come about because people are afraid that taxes are going to get higher. And it's this fear of future taxes that really gives these movements the kind of grassroots energy that they have.
Is it the taxes or how the money's going to be spent? Or is, I mean, how are they related in the mind, or the, I guess the, in the essence of these movements?
Well, there obviously is a long tradition in American politics of basically of racism and of racist perceptions that the federal government is doing things that benefit black people, and a lot of white voters don't support the federal government because they think it's going to unworthy people. But I think in these kind of grassroots movements, I think we tend to underestimate how much the tax stuff really does drive it. I think people wouldn't care so much how the federal government was spending its money if they weren't afraid that the federal government was then going to come after their property to pay for it. And I think when people are concerned about taxes, they'll scapegoat whichever federal programs they dislike the most. But I see a lot of that as sort of scapegoating, picking on federal programs that people happen to dislike to justify a real worry about their own property and their own taxes.
So for these movements to arise, it seems, and correct me if I'm wrong, but there needs to be basically this fertile ground that exists, and then there needs to be one policy that they can sort of describe as the penultimate, or the ultimate threat. And meanwhile, it also seems like there's these sort of low-level issues that sort of maintain the support for this sort of spike in activity. So if that's the case, what happens to the Tea Party? I mean, because I'm convinced the Tea Party is also, it's 50% fundamentalist, according to the research. And so those issues like abortion, like women's rights, like gay equality are always going to be sort of buzzing in the background. But for this Tea Party, the Affordable Care Act became sort of the spike that pushed them over the edge. And like you say, brought out during those town hall meetings. So what happens if the Affordable Care Act does not destroy America 18 months from now or whatever it is?
The Tea Party is going to have to find another issue, and I think it's going to be immigration.
Immigration.
I think if you look at the attitudes of the Tea Party base, people are very concerned about immigration. And I think if you look at the history of radical right movements like the Tea Party in Europe, they have all undergone this transition from starting out as tax protest organizations. And then when the tax issue dies down, because it becomes clear that the tax in question was not the beginning of the end of the world, all of the successful radical right parties in Europe have transitioned to being anti-immigrant parties. So that's my concern about the future direction of the Tea Party. I think it's a likely path, and I think it's one we should be looking out for.
Didn't they in some ways come from that? I mean, don't we see a lot of those sort of Minutemen type of people having integrated back into the Tea Party? And so you are anticipating sort of that reemergence, and that's going to be ugly, isn't it?
Oh, it's going to be ugly, and it's going to be some fights within the Tea Party, obviously. There's some of the major funders of the Tea Party who are pretty liberal on immigration issues because they employ a lot of immigrants or would like to. But I think in the grassroots base, a lot of the concern that Tea Party members express in opinion polls about federal spending, if you scratch those responses, if you ask people follow-up questions about what the worry is, a lot of times what they'll say is they're worried about the federal money going to immigrants, and there's this feeling that the nation is under threat. So I think that perception is out there. I think it's a pretty big part of the Tea Party base, and I think at least some Tea Party organizations are going to figure out that when they can't make hay about the Obamacare issue anymore, they're going to start trying to make hay out of that one.
Interesting. Isaac William Martin, author of Rich People's Movements, Grassroots Campaigns to Untax the 1%. Thanks so much for your time today.
Thanks so much for having me.
All right, folks. And now it is time for us to head into the fun part of the show. Just a reminder, podcastawards.com. Head over there and vote. We only have three more days. You only have three more chances to vote, folks. to make sure that the podcast you listen to on a daily or twice weekly or thrice weekly or force weekly is an award-winning podcast. In the better half, we will talk about Rand Paul's concern that the federal government is outlawing donuts. And we will be talking about the sound of that Craig Cobb. You remember that the guy who wanted to create a all white town in North Dakota? He got a rude awakening when he went on a TV show to check his DNA. I guess I don't know why this guy gets on TV shows. What
does he get to be in that town? We'll
find out. More on obviously the horrible disaster in the Philippines and a very moving speech or clips of a speech given by Yeb Sano, who is the Philippines representative to the climate talks, the UN's climate talks in Warsaw, Poland. Very moving, and in fact has inspired, he is fasting, and has inspired people around the world to fast in solidarity with him as a way of pushing what's going on in Warsaw. So we will talk about all that and more in the fun half of the show. Folks, you can support this program to make sure that you continue to get 40 minutes of programming a day and get a bonus 50 minutes by becoming a member at majority.fm. We rely on memberships for 99.3% of our operating revenue. Of course, we have a huge stash of underground gold and bitcoins that we're betting a lot on. But in the meantime, our operating revenue comes exclusively from your membership. So please become a member today. If you're buying crap on Amazon, there is absolutely no reason why you wouldn't be buying it through our link. Go to majority.fm, click on the link, bookmark it. Always buy your Amazon crap there if you buy through Amazon, and we get a kickback. JustCoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. Want to be a part of the program? Give us a call, 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920 is the number. You can IM me at any one of our IMs. Majority Reporter, Majority FM on AOL Instant Messaging, Majority FM at jabber.org, or you can IM me directly from the app. You can get the app today, majorityapp.com. If you're over there, give us a good review. Give us a good review on iTunes. Let's do this. I'm talking to you like a man right now.
Kind of talking like Chris Matthews, to be honest.
Oh, am I?
It's a little Matthews-y.
iTunes. Vote for us there. Post a review.
I'm talking to you like a man. Even if you're a lady. What?
You hear that, Matty D?
What? No, I'm not.
Cedar's using the Matthews voice to call you a lady.
No, I'm not. All right, folks. See you in the better half.